There's nothing like a nice hedge maze at the height of summer to make one feel as if anything could happen. Romance, intrigue.
An acute awareness of the futility of life.
No, Latimer, today is a nice day and nothing horrible is going to happen. Are we clear?
In that case, I'd suggest turning right here, Mum.
Oh, all right. There's nothing bad in the other direction, is there?
As long as we follow these directions to the centre of the maze, nothing unpleasant will befall us.
Oh, good. You did send a copy of those directions to our guest, didn't you? Didn't you? Latimer? Tea and Jeopardy with Emma Newman. There's always time for a nice cup of tea and a spot of mild peril. Well, hello there, my lovelies. I do hope you're well and haven't had to give a small child the definition of decapitation recently. I'm Emma Newman, and I'd like to welcome you into my secret tea lair for polite conversation, abject geekery, a cheeky bit of cake, and of course, a nice cup of tea. Even though we're outdoors, the centre of this hedge maze feels remarkably cosy. I've been told that this maze is over 300 years old and formed by thousands of manicured yew trees. I do recommend that you stay in the centre with us so you don't get lost. There are lots of cushions for you to sit on and enough cake for everyone.
I'm sorry to disturb you, Mum, but as promised, your guest has arrived, physically intact and no less stable than when he left his house this morning. Mr. Kieran Gillen.
Oh, splendid. Let's see his calling card. Mr. Kieran M. Gillen, word scientist and ludocrat apostate.
Are we to infer that Mr. Gillen is now being hunted by the ludocracy?
I don't think it's the same as being a mage apostate. At least I hope not.
I'll prepare an escape route just in case, Mum.
Marvellous. Show him over, Latimer. For those of you who don't know, Kieran Gillen forged a very successful career as a games journalist, went on to found the games blog Rock Paper Shotgun, and then, as if that wasn't enough, became a writer for Marvel. He has written Thor, Young Avengers and Iron Man, amongst many others. He's currently enjoying well-deserved success and recognition for The Wicked and the Divine, which is illustrated by Jamie McKelvey.
Mr. Kieran Gillen, Mum.
Hello, Kieran. Do come and sit down. How are you?
I'm fine. I'm not exactly sure how I got here, but I like it.
Well, you probably dozed off on the way. I find that a lot of our guests do seem to sleep on the way here.
Yes, I'm kind of easily confused. That's my major thing. So sleeping is good, and it probably allows me to segue from my normal life into this fantastical world you've taken me to.
Yes, it's a lovely maze, isn't it?
It's lovely. It's so verdant.
Yes, that's a wonderful word. We don't use that enough in conversation. Yeah. Would you care for some tea?
That sounds fantastic. I would love to have some tea, thank you.
How do you take your tea?
I take my tea very simple. I would like a vaguely sort of builder's tea with milk, no sugar. Thank you.
Marvellous. And I'll pour. And I was wondering if you would like some lardy cake.
Oh, that sounds delightful. Thank you very much.
It is delightful. And I also like the way that you can't actually say it without sounding a little bit cheeky.
It is a bit. It's got lardy cake.
Yeah. Exactly. It's very, very rich and very, very sweet and ideal for such an occasion.
I always order tiramisu from in a restaurant if it's on the menu just because I like saying it. It's the word tiramisu. And it's like, you know.
It's almost like a well-controlled sneeze.
Yes.
You don't mind chickens, do you? You're not allergic to them?
Not I'm aware of.
Oh, good. Well, they won't bother you. They've got a nice space over there to have a little peck around in the grass, so they'll be quite happy. They won't go for your shoelaces, I'm sure.
I'm sure they won't click with me. God, that's awful. That's awful. Please, kill me.
I've been warned about your puns,
dear.
Sir.
I'm in character, so careful.
It's okay. Lee Harris was my editor once upon a time, and yes, if you can survive Lee's puns, you know, I've been hardened to this. It's fine. I can take it. Yes. So the invitation I sent you, I asked you to bring a curio with you. What have you decided to bring today?
It's a difficult object to actually observe, so I brought this enormous electron microscope with me, which you see on my backpack, which I brought for the occasion, which I've set up by our tea table. And if you observe through yonder observing scope, because I'm a scientist, I'm probably aware of the correct terminology. Did you look through that, Emma?
Yeah, I thought, yes.
You see the very faint glow, and that's my optimism for the future. which is very small now, but is still visible.
Yes, only just visible. What magnification are we working at here?
Very, very magnified.
Very.
Very.
Wow. Well, at least it's still there.
That is good. We need to observe it to make sure it is. That's the thing.
Ah, I see. Is this like a kind of a Schrodinger's optimism for the future? It's only there if you observe it?
I would hope so. I would rather not take the risk of it not. Because if I stop looking into it and it disappears, that's pretty bad for everyone, especially me.
Yeah, so perhaps you should employ somebody to keep looking at it for you, just to make sure that that quantum state is collapsed at all times.
There's a reason why I work with Jamie McKelvey, and it, trust me, it's not his art.
He's not the one keeping track of your optimism.
I'm afraid he is.
I wanted to ask you about the creative process with Jamie, actually. Kim Curran asked me to ask you about that over Twitter, because I understand that comic writers vary quite widely in the level of descriptive detail they provide with, you know, the script and the dialogue and things. I was wondering where you are on that scale of either describing every single limb position of a character through to, yeah, whatever you think looks best.
It depends how lazy I'm feeling that day.
Really,
it depends on the artist, and it depends on the project, and it depends on a lot of other things. My general rule is, I write whatever needs to be written. So in other words, if the limb position is genuinely important, I will say that. If it's not, I won't. You know, depending on the... Some artists are very into the interiority of the characters. So in other words, I can just talk about how they feel. You know, as in, and then they are entirely capable of working out the body language themselves. In fact, they would consider it rude for me to give any more direction. Another artist is much more about the exterior, the spectacle, if you will. And in which case, then, if there's something specifically I want, I will call for it. So it varies. With Jamie, it's kind of, the scripts tend to be heavy, but that's partially because I fill a lot of in-jokes in there. And partially because with Jamie, rather than saying, okay, we'll do it, this is how I think we should do it, but do it another way if you want, I might, if it's a big like action set piece or some real visual element, I might write, here are five or six ways I think we could do it. So it's more like a commission. Or like a conversation. It's kind of the first off of a conversation. And then Jamie will get back to me and will, you know, throw sketches and problems, and we'll go on the phone. So it's kind of, it's the start of a conversation rather than the end of one. But all my scripts tend to be conversational.
Okay, so it must be an interesting stage right at the start if you're working with a new artist, figuring out the way to work best with each other.
Oh, absolutely. It's the kind of the magic of comics. It's, one reason why I'm attracted to comics is that you get a chance to be, in some weird way, the audience for your own story. As opposed to like prose, which of course sits there and it's immaculate and it's exactly how you left it, unless your editor's being really shitty. comics is like, I will write a script and then it will be transformed by another creative body, and you get the chance then of seeing something that's both yours and not yours.
Yeah.
So that's at least part of it. So you're trying to see actually how the transformation works between the artist and you. So you spend lots. I spend some time looking at the artist and see what they've done previously, what they're good at, where their weaknesses are, what appears to excite them. You know, I talk to them. You know, especially if I've worked with them a few times, I then say, where do you really want to take your art next? And you know, depending on the artist, that can get interesting areas.
Cool.
I think this is quite common. I know Robin Ellis is this. The first scripts tend to be more elaborate than later scripts, because the first scripts are all basically trying to cover your asses to see what works and what doesn't. When you see the interplay between the people, you start leading into that. I mean, working with Phil Jimenez on Angela at the moment, he is a writer himself, but B, he's a fascinating storyteller, so he's added, like, if we're at a 5-panel page, he'll do it like a 9-panel page. And not many artists don't want to do 9-panel pages, so in later scripts I've kind of gone, well, if he's happy to do 9-panel pages, I'm going to write some 9-panel pages.
Ah, yeah, so it evolves over time, and I guess when you become more comfortable with each other. A bit like marriage.
Yes, absolutely. This is kind of, people are always very kind to me and Jamie's work. And one of the reasons why we do work like we do together is because we've been doing it for 12 years. And we've kind of, instead of making a new relationship, then we're very, very familiar with what we do and why we do it. And the stuff I would ask Jamie to do, I wouldn't ask many artists to do. Not least, they would probably punch me.
Well, like observing your optimism.
Exactly.
I'm sure there are many who would never do that.
No, there's not many artists I would trust to observe my optimism.
You mentioned something called the Marvel Method in a panel at Nine Worlds. I was wondering if you could describe what that is.
Okay, I paraphrase roughly. The Marvel Method was invented by Stan Lee in the 1960s when he was writing at Marvel. The thing is that basically there was one writer at Marvel who was Stan Lee and a load of artists. And of course the artists were also storytellers, and it's more complicated than that. And frankly, someone's about to throw a brick at me for this very bad paraphrasing. However, the idea being that rather than... Since you couldn't do full script, and full script is basically like the world's most anal screenplay. full script is what comics traditionally was done. So page one, panel one, picture of Superman standing on a building. Page two, page one, panel two, close-up on Superman talking about truth, justice, and the American way. That's the describing every element. That can go from the one single exciting telegram in the John Wagner approach all the way up to the Alan Moore novel. A Marvel method instead puts a lot more primacy in the artist. So it would basically give a description of the story, which then the artist interprets into comics. And the amount of story can vary. Some people would like, you know, the apocryphal stories about the original plot of the Fantastic Four, the Galactus thing was Fantastic Four fight God. That was the whole Marvel method script, which I have no idea whether it's true or not, but that's something people say. But more likely is, the more common way of Marvel method is, like, you say, page one, this happens. Superman's standing on a building, he's thinking about this kind of stuff. Page two, a bad guy turns up, it can still have an enormous amount of difference of writing in. I mean, generally speaking, the people I know who do use Marvel method quite regularly now, people like Mark Waid, people like Alan Ewing, people like Matt Fraction, they will include at least some dialogue, because I think it's quite hard for artists to get a sense of how much dialogue they need to leave room for. And I think, knowing what one line people are saying really helps. As Fraction puts, if you describe something in a paragraph which sounds like one action, that probably means one panel. So it's like he's on some level all thinking about how he would panel it, but without actually putting numbers on it.
Okay.
So that's the kind of difference. Basically, the reason why it was invented by Stan Lee is it abstractly can be much quicker. Because the other thing about Marvel method is, whilst it's also interpreted by the artist, then the writer comes along after the script is written to add the dialogue. Sorry, after the artist's drawn.
Right.
The process, here's the story, artist draws an interpretation of that story, writer comes back saying, what the hell can I add to this picture? You know, what in hell can Doctor Doom be saying at this point in the story? And the advantage is, of course, it's quicker than doing full script, and it gives more freedom to the artist, and it's kind of there's a sort of sympathetic magic going on there.
Yeah.
From the writer's perspective, the disadvantage is that occasionally an artist just goes completely and utterly apeshit.
Yeah.
And the one I always learned from Warren Ellis talking about was, you may think this is two pages of exposition, and instead, you get a page back of a double page spread of a dinosaur. And all of a sudden, because you're up against deadline and no chance to get anything redrawn, you're trying to work out how on earth you can add dialogue to this page of a dinosaur to make your story work. So, yeah. The advantage of full script, it will generally create a story that works almost all the time. The advantage of like Marvel method, it kind of leaves more room for improvisation.
Yeah, as a writer, that just kind of scares me, not knowing what would come back. It's a bit like improvisational drama.
Yes.
But you have to have a comic at the end of it. That's quite scary.
It's utterly petrifying. Marvel method really is about trust. I do use Marvel method occasionally with Jamie. We kind of use a hybrid method where half fits in full script and half fits in Marvel method. And it's sections where things are a bit more fluid. They're like the fight sequences in Young Avengers would be the best example. I use a hybrid approach because basically different forms of scripting seems to work best for different sorts of scenes. I mean, things like this scene in Young Avengers where we've got this, it's all done as a diagrammatic fight scene. And it's that kind of, that's a really impossible thing to script. So I end up writing Marvel method, which in real life is much more like a commission. As in, okay, this is what the page should do, how can we approach it? And then I give a load of different ideas. It still is a leap of faith, essentially, Marvel method.
Yeah. I've stumbled across a quote in an interview that you gave about the Warhammer 40K comic. And it was quite interesting. And obviously, because you've had, 11 billion interviews, I'll read you the quote so you know which one I'm talking about. You said, as I suspect will become terribly apparent over time, my basal state for narrative endings is spheric victory or tragedy. If you just leave me to it, the story will end with most of the cast dead or wishing they were dead, and I have to fight against that instinct. Where do you think that instinct comes from?
It's weird because I'm basically quite an optimistic person, despite the fact my optimism is so small. I'm basically quite cheery. I probably laugh more than I should. That's one of my basal things. I'm also quite artistically morbid, I guess. I think, I find these things very powerful. I think it's telling that some of the most important parts of the Western literature canon are tragedies. This is kind of very much at the core of Wycliffe. It's like we've got about 70 years to live, and why the hell be an artist anyway? That kind of basic nihilism. A lot of my favourite bands or artists have at least, at worst, outright depression, and best, a kind of mania. So, I find these things profound and moving. At the same time, I think nihilism sucks. And it's kind of like I always lean existentialism rather than nihilistic. As in the idea of it, a blank canvas to make choices on. That's much more my kind of position. So I find this kind of much more natural. That's where my mind goes. And then I actually interrogate that instinct. I genuinely change away from that initial bleak thing to, actually, no, this is not what you believe. You know, and this isn't actually what you want to put into the world, even.
So it's like a dialogue with yourself.
Yeah, as in it's like, you know, sometimes my first instinct is very good and sometimes my first instinct is very bad. And it's always a question, so why are you actually doing that anyway? And it's like, why, you know, it's like, I tend to interrogate what I do.
Yes.
So yeah, that's an interesting quote. I tend to think irony is the way I work now, mostly. As in, I kind of like, not as in, like, distance from my work, but just, to be honest, some degree of that. The idea that I'm generally saying multiple things at the same time. And I think that the overall truth of the work is about synthesising all those contradictory things and seeing what the overall picture is. And I genuinely think life is complicated. And that's not really particularly a deep thing to say, life is complicated.
But I think that's still an important thing to examine and to play with in a world where all of the media and all of the messages and politics and everything that we're bombarded with is so reductionist and so oversimplified.
Oh, no, absolutely. That's why I do it. It's that the idea of when I did my Spartan, like, Slave Hunt 3, which is kind of an inversion of the Thermopylae story, sort of it's three Helot slaves on the run from 300 Spartans. And that could have very easily been a very dialectic story, and to be honest, to some degree it is. But at the same time, I end up doing quite a lot about the Spartans and quite a lot about the Spartan who was thrown out of the culture because he was viewed as a trembler, a coward. And between the how those different stories delineate and end up, you get something a little bit more than, oh, those Spartans, they certainly treated their slaves bad, you know, and all like, ooh, it's very bad for people to keep slaves, you know, that's kind of what I like doing. And I think occasionally, to my detriment, but I think it's kind of the core of what I do. I mean, it's part of it, when we're doing Wictive, there's a sense, you know, there are 12 gods who reincarnate, and each one is explicitly exploring a failing. I can never pronounce the word hamartia, you know, the Greek, the tragic flaw of the heroic character and all that. But there's definitely a sense that every one of these characters is about exploring one problem of living life as a creative human, and that the limitations of that particular problem are brought into sharp focus as you go through the whole thing. So yeah, I like complexity.
Mm. Will Hill said on Twitter that I should ask you about the Marvel retreats, and my first thought was, there are Marvel retreats? But are these like beautiful gardens and you have quiet rooms for contemplating mundanities after, you know, being in a world full of superheroes? What is the Marvel retreat?
It's not the Marvel retreat, it's like basically there's a front line between DC and Marvel. Basically, in summer, during the spring offensives, the DC attack us, and we have to retreat to the second line of trench.
Oh, it's that kind of retreat!
That's true. It's a very different kind of retreat. And then we counter-attack, and it all goes back to normal. And the war never ends.
Yes, the eternal war.
basically, it's not that fun or interesting, sadly. It's very much they get their exclusive writers over to normally to New York at the moment. It happens about twice a year, and they put you in a big room of like about 15 writers and about 15 editors, and you argue about who's going to be punching who for the next 2 years.
Excellent.
So it's that kind of like, it really that kind of the big scale. Okay, in 2 years' time, we're going to have the big event. Or we know where we're heading. So it's that kind of like the stewardship of the universe, where the major characters are going, that kind of thing. So it really is, that's the format. So if I go there, I'm talking about what books I'm doing, you might pitch stories, you might be saying your direction, and then basically the room gets to tear it to shreds or cheer it, depending what mood people are in.
Wow, that sounds both amazingly wonderful and awful all at the same time.
It's all right. It's, I think amazingly awful might be nearer the point. But it's like, you know, a lot of mumbling writers in a room is rarely going to be that. I'm laughing. There's actually camaraderie, and it's interesting, and it's like any gathering of humans that there's politics there. You know, it's the kind of the basic, you know, different people who have different views of characters and all that kind of stuff, and that's just very natural in terms of any group of things. But yeah, it's certainly, I imagine it's less interesting than most people imagining it, but on the other hand, it's still kind of amazing. Like, after a good summit, you kind of go away and you know, like, oh, this is what Jonathan Hickman's got planned for the next 2 years. I mean, when Jonathan was starting his Avengers, he just laid out his entire Avengers run because that's what Jonathan does. And it's like, you have a sort of smile that you kind of know all this, and it's like, wow, these people are brilliant. And when you pitch something in the room that goes well, is excellent, because you've been working on this. It's kind of like show and tell meets, you know, creative writer room criticism, I guess.
I want to imagine it like a really grand ballroom, and you're all there in fine costume and masks, and kind of like the Illuminati deciding the course of the world for the next few years. That's Can I keep that for myself?
I don't
want anyone to spoil that image.
Me and another writer actually said we wanted to do a crossover, a big Marvel event, which is basically like the Marvel Retreat, but with supervillains.
Yes.
Like the supervillains get around, they try to work out how they're going to take over the world. Like, who's going to do what? Oh, I don't want him to do that. I hate that guy. I'm just doing it as a very, very over-the-top meta parody of ourselves.
Yeah.
But that's why I don't get that's why I don't get to write the big events, I suspect.
Now, I have a two-part question for you next. So the first part is, now, I must admit, when I was thinking this through this morning, I was a bit nervous about this, but let's see how it goes. So the first part is, what is the part of your body you are most proud of?
Ow, that's a question. My tongue's the one which turns up in most conversations. I've got a double prehensile tongue, so I can, like, you know, some people can curl their tongue. I can double curl my tongue, as in curl it two ways at once. Like, basically, I can form an S with my tongue.
Okay.
And that's quite impressive. As a kid, I used to claim I could be able to spell the alphabet with my tongue, which isn't quite true. But you have to use a bit of imagination. We were at the Image Expo, and we were talking about things about our body, so I was demonstrating that. And Chip Zdarsky, cartoonist and general monster of Sex Criminals, he can turn his ankle 360 degrees.
No.
Yeah, he did it, and it was kind of. It's mainly his. It's not just his ankle; it's much more his knee as well. So he's got to between the two of them, he can fit just like 280 degrees. And he did this, and it's just the waitress was passing, and she just stopped and like thought he broke his leg. She was genuinely worried for a second, it was completely the freakiest thing I've seen in quite a while. So yeah, I'm not surprising many people by saying that Chip is a freak, but that is definitely true.
Okay, so the first part of the question is that the answer is your tongue. So the second part, if you had to choose an enchantment cast on that part of your body for an hour a day, would it be making it glow with a bright light, or giant growth, or the ability to grow berries from it, which have restorative properties?
Wow. It's already quite big. As in, basically, it looks like I've got an enormous soup ladle in my tongue. So making it B has to be out, because it would just be freaky and weird. Glowing, generally speaking, I like berries, and I know my wife likes berries as well. So the idea of having a regular daily supply of berries, and in fact healing berries, that strikes me as definitely the option I would go for.
Yeah, you just have to schedule it into your diary that there'll be an hour a day where you wouldn't be able to speak, but then you just feel awesome afterwards after eating all the berries.
Yeah, I'm assuming as soon as the berries appear, I could like knock them off into a bowl.
Yeah.
You know, just like watching television. Like maybe, depending, if we can make it like after eating, but before we have like dessert. Like, we have a long gap between eating and dessert. That would probably work.
Yeah. And I can't believe we're thinking about it this hard.
No, it's definitely only one of them gives me any useful power. Like, you know what I mean?
Yes.
I can't see why anyone would choose any other option from C in that kind of way.
Well, I don't know. Glowing with a bright light, you know, if you're scared of the dark, you'd never... Oh, I suppose it may be for an hour a day. Yeah, that is a bit rubbish, isn't it?
Yeah.
But anyway, so when I'm about to have a friend over for tea, I like to ask on the Twitters if anyone has any questions. And my goodness, my Twitter went insane when I asked this. But I've teased one out, which I thought was quite interesting. Someone asked if you ever see yourself writing prose in terms of stories or novels, or is it only comics for you?
A friend of the political journalist and writer, Laurie Penny, and she asked me, are you working on any priorities? Oh, I only write personal projects. And she went, oh, you mean porn then? Anytime a writer says they're working on a personal project, it means porn. which I thought, she's probably right, actually, now I think about it. Laurie's not entirely a stupid person, bless her. I like prose. It's, I came from a background as journalism and criticism, so it's like I write a lot of prose. It's, you know, there's still a lot of that exists. In terms of fiction, I used to kind of have a kind of like argumentative thing. This is mainly to wind up Warren. It's like, why would anyone, you know, it's a culturally dead art form. You're never going to write Ulysses. You know, all the great battles have been won. It's fundamentally towards the, you know, it might as well write poetry. You know, in comics, there's still a brave uphill battle to be fought. You know, that you would get to fight on the losing side of history, and as opposed to who would join the winners. But that was mainly like agitprop, kind of like flag waving nonsense. You never know. I mean, it's kind of like, if I did prose, I suspect it would very much have to be something which had to be prose. I'm not particularly interested in prose for the sake of prose. It kind of, the thing that attracted me to comics wasn't to actually just tell a story, it was tell a story through comics. That's kind of why I'm kind of generally do full script, because the problem with Marvel Method is, it doesn't feel like I'm writing a comic. I'm writing an idea which is then interpreted into a comic.
Yes.
So that's why I'm quite anal. I'm not over descriptive, but I'm quite anal in my scripts. As in implying this is something I think will work. And even if they go a different way, the idea was still there. With prose, it's like, it would have to be something which, I think, Swim of Two Birds? I've just literally forgot the author. Something which works with the ideas of impossibilities. I really enjoyed Ancillary Justice, Anne Leckie, which I read, and that, the stuff she does with perception, in terms of the AI systems and all that, that would be really hard to do in comics. See what I mean? Mm-hmm. And then, this is an idea which suits prose more than comics, rather than comics and prose. And to be honest, I've had a few of them. But I also am aware that as a prose stylist, I hold up best over a single caption. I am sloppy and need desperate editing, and I am not immaculate and beautiful. And considering most of my favourite, people who I do love in prose are so immaculate at it, I'm not sure it suits me. And I've got a kind of the fact that I feel so much trashy all the time makes me kind of shun away from it. But you never say never. And people certainly ask me if I'm interested in doing something, and I've occasionally gone, if an idea turns up.
Yeah. So you announced the Ludocrats a couple of weeks ago at Image Expo. Can you tell me something about that?
Ah, the Ludocrats. That's just me, to sit in the middle of a maze sipping tea is the ideal place to talk about the Ludocrats. basically, the aristocrats of the ludicrous. The idea is kind of like a never-ending story kind of thing, but for mostly grown-ups. not particularly grown-ups, but very much so. People defending, these aristocrats of the ludicrous, defending the realms of infinite possibility from the crushing forces of normalisation. Thrillers, Baron Otto von Subutton and Professor Hades Zero-K face these banal creatures and all that. It's basically me and a friend of mine called Jim Rosamill, who I used to know we had the idea back in 2002, even, and we've played with it ever since. And just before Christmas, David LaFuente, who's an amazing artist who I've known for years, kind of said, I need to do a book immediately. Do you want to do something? And I suddenly found myself thinking, wait, this is probably the right time to do Ludocrats. So it's a very broad adventure comedy, and it features a massive compounding of weirdness and funness. The idea, most weirdness for weirdness aesthetics comics tend to be kind of alienating. People kind of assume there's a joke they're not getting. Whilst Ludocrats kind of runs on bonhomie. It's very much arms around you. Come on, this is all very stupid. Let's just enjoy it together, my friends.
Wow, that sounds a lot like Tea and Jeopardy.
I was thinking that myself. It's kind of like there's a lot of that kind of aesthetic in there. I'm very sure Otto especially would come along and he would have a hell of a time. He's a big fan of tea. What tea would he have? He would have all the teas. I would like to have milk and not milk. And all that. But yeah, it's kind of also, there's kind of an asterisk and obelix kind of thing, with, except Otto is the kind of the lead, and he's the obelix kind of iddy part of the relationship. And Hades is kind of the asterisk mode, and she's kind of long-suffering, and trying to desperately keep control of this ravenous monster she called a friend.
Oh, it's a super ego kind of thing.
Yes, very much so.
Cool.
It's fun. Basically, it's the idea, 2014 was terrible. And I thought, and a lot of my books are incredibly, quite, work is about death. It's about pop stars and death, but it's mainly about death. I wrote this book called Uber, which is about, World War II was really bad. So I'm kind of wading in all this stuff. And I thought, I think I should do something that is raging against the dying of a light in a much more aggressive and fun way. So that's the kind of thing. We thought this is a really...
Yeah.
And I think David is an incredible artist, really phenomenally imaginative. He just got out his contract with Marvel. And he's been doing lovely work for Marvel, but it's very much in the idiom of the realistic mode superhero. And he's somebody who has an unhinged imagination. So he, at the same time, we're just throwing our imaginations at the page and having so much fun stuff in there, really.
That's marvellous. I think there is a very important role for silliness in dark times.
Yes, absolutely. We're quite aggressive about it. When we announced it at the Image Expo, I actually read a manifesto, the announcement of Ludocracy. So I practiced that and had it mostly memorised. It'll be online at some point, but it's kind of that was an aggressive statement of belief in the power of fiction and joy.
Yes, yes, yes. I will raise my teacup to joy.
That's just clink them, yes.
Yes. Now, the next question, I'm really worried that I'm actually going to give you some kind of aneurysm when I ask you for an answer, but I was wondering if you could decide which song would be the theme tune of your life so that we can ask the singing chickens if they know it.
That's really tricky. As I said, it's like, I've been thinking about this. People always ask me, what's your favourite album, what you've been listening to recently? Because I do so much books about pop music and culture, and I'm not very good at lists. Lists kind of make me go, as you say, the aneurysm kind of, brain fail moment. And like, it's like, it's a toss up between Jingle Bells or the you are the generation who bought more shoes and you get what you deserve, which was A No Hit Wonder by a band called Johnny Boy. And that kind of like defined most of my noughties. What's opening that? It's kind of Mannix meets Phil Spector kind of political pop song with an amazing song, which is, I think one reviewer described it as all crescendo, which is very, very accurate. It kind of, it really is incredibly joyous. I can't help believing Season Me Cursed is the opening line, which is, struck me as a very much an iconic thing when I was like doing my wannabe creativeness to this. So yes, you are the generation who bought my shoes and you get what you deserve by Johnny Boy.
Okay, Little Chickens, You Are the Generation Who Bought More Shoes and You Get What You Deserve by Johnny Boy. Okay, well, there you go. They know it. Even if it is an obscure song, they know it.
Well done, them.
Well, let me just check that. Oh, I'm afraid the teapot is empty.
Mm.
Oh, and we'll have to pack away the electron microscope back into this very small backpack of yours. That might take a few moments for Latimer to see too. But I just wanted to say thank you so much. I understand how busy you are, and I really do appreciate you taking the time to come and have tea today.
It's been utterly delightful. I would never turn down an opportunity for tea, even with someone I despised. But someone so charming, it was a delight.
I'm so glad you added that extra Well, do take care. I'm sure you'll be able to find your way back out of the maze again. I think you just do what you did on the way in, but in reverse. It'll be fine.
Excellent. I'll give it a shot.
Yes, what could possibly go wrong?
I'm sure nothing could possibly go wrong.
No. Bye. You'll be fine. Bye.
This way, sir.
Shouldn't you escort him out, Latimer?
Oh, no, ma'am. I've taken the liberty of procuring these angled mirrors on extendable arms, so that we can watch his progress out of the maze without having to leave the comfort of the centre.
Oh, yes, I can see him. I do think it's more civilised to escort him out, though.
That would be far too dangerous. What with the Minotaur?
The Minotaur? But this is a hedge maze in Surrey. Oh, no, it's found him.
Lorx, it's the Minotaur.
The shock must have driven all of the emotion from his voice.
I'm so terribly sorry, but I'm going to have to gore you and feast on your innards. Hope that's not too inconvenient.
At least he's polite. Much better than those purely archetypical Minotaurs. All they do is grunt.
But how did it get here? Why do I have the feeling you're involved with this, Latimer?
It isn't my fault, ma'am. All mazes and labyrinths are inherently linked across all dimensions. We should consider ourselves lucky. There are much worse things than Morris out there.
Morris? You're on first-name terms?
I gave him elocution lessons, ma'am.
Well, Kieran looks remarkably calm. Or is he still in shock?
Any last words before I devour you?
You don't understand, Minotaur. I will defeat you with the unlikely offspring between a bull and a rocky outcrop from a hill. The infamous Minotaur.
What? Eh? I think you're a little confused, old chap. I'm the Minotaur. I'm the one doing the defeating here. Aren't I?
Run, Kieran, whilst he's still confused.
Bull and a rocky outcrop. No, I don't understand. Doesn't make any sense. Hang on, where's my lunch gone?
Go left, Kieran. Or is it right? No, it's reversed in the mirror. Oh, dear. No, go right! Go right! Oh, thank goodness he's made it to the exit. Poor Morris still looks quite perplexed.
Tor. Think Tor. Mountain. Bit of rock. Glastonbury Tor. As hill. Think about it.
Oh, it's a pun! It's so bad I've lost my appetite. I'm going home. Latimer, you owe me lunch. Give me a call, old chap.
Cup of tea, ma'am?
I think it's going to take more than tea, Latimer.
Biscuit, ma'am?
This had better be a very fine biscuit.
I'll fetch it at once, ma'am.
Well, while Latimer is searching for the best biscuit in the entire world, I'd like to raise my teacup to the newest member of the Order of the Sacred Teacup, Eleanor Matten Johnson. Should you wish to join the esteemed order and discover how Latimer became my butler, go to patreon.com/TeaAndJeopardy. Find me a new tea there, would you, Latimer? One without any monsters, for goodness sake.
Very good, Mom.
You've just listened to an episode of Tea and Jeopardy, hosted by Emma Newman and co-written with Peter Newman. Go to www.teaandjeopardy.com to find previous episodes and www.patreon.com/TeaAndJeopardy to become a Bless Poppet.